morning. It's a little past 9 o'clock, so I think we'll get started. My name is Michael Goldman. I'm the Vice Chair of the Safety and Security Committee meeting. Chair Mr. Downey is running a little late today, and he's asked me to begin so we can stay on schedule. We'll start, as we usually do, with a little safety words of wisdom from Mr. Dougherty. Jim?
Thank you, Chairman Goldman, and members of the board. Good morning.
Morning.
In the event we have an alarm activation, we'd ask that you exit through one of the marked exit doors to my right or left, across the street using a crosswalk at H and Fifth Street, and assemble in front of the National Building Museum so that we can account for everyone. Our safety contact with the Thanksgiving holiday coming up, although it's primarily a holiday celebrating the United States and Canada, it's a day of thanks for the blessings of the harvest and of the preceding year. A common tradition time of this year is to deep fry a turkey. This can be done safely if you follow these simple safety tips. Have a fire extinguisher ready at all times in the event that the oil ignites. Set the turkey fryer more than 10 feet, at least 10 feet, away from your home on flat, level ground. Never leave the hot oil unattended, and don't allow children or pets near the cooking area. Use a thawed and dry turkey to prevent the oil from bubbling over. Turkey must reach an internal temperature of 165 degrees Fahrenheit or above to consume. The turkey must, use a meat thermometer in the thickest part of the turkey to ensure the turkey reached the correct internal temperature. Allow the oil to cool completely before disposal or storage. Immediately wash your hands, utensils, equipment, and surfaces that have come in contact with the raw turkey. And as always, the turkey should be consumed immediately and left over stored in a refrigerator. Thank you, and have a safe day. A great Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Is your report on the turkey frying based on experience or some academic knowledge?
I will tell you, in my former life as a police officer, our fire department did the experience with the frozen turkey in the deep fryer. So I had quite a scene. I went to consume, though. So thank you.
Yes, we are now have representatives from all the constituent jurisdictions. So the first order of business is the approval of the agenda. Has everyone had an opportunity to review that? If so, I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second? All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. And has everyone had an opportunity to approve the minutes from the last meeting of October 23rd, 2014?
The minutes of October 23rd.
Second? All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much. We'll move on to today's presentations. We have two informational items that are scheduled this morning. First, Deputy General Manager Rob Troop will provide us with an overview of how Metro will use $21 million in grant funding that we've recently received from the federal government, the Federal Transit Administration, to protect the system against possible future flooding events and to harden the system against water intrusion. The board has previously approved submission of the successful grant request to the FTA. This is federal money made available in the wake of Hurricane Sandy to prevent future such incidences, not the hurricane, but the hardening of transit systems and other infrastructure as a result of it. Then the committee will receive a quarterly update from the chair of the Tri-State Overstate Committee, including information on TOC's oversight of the Silver Line and a review of the 7,000 Series Railcar Program, as well as Metro's progress to address corrective action plan items. In addition, Mr. Troop will provide us with a briefing on Tuesday's third rail power outage in the system, which caused delays on the orange, silver, and blue lines. So I'll now turn to Deputy General Manager Troop for the review of the federal resiliency grant applications and how those grants will be implemented.
Great, thank you so much. And I, good morning, and I'm really pleased today to brief the committee on the $21 million federal award that Metro recently received from the Federal Transit Administration. And these funds will be used to carry out permanent hardening measures that better prepare our system for major storms and other natural disasters. In December of 2013, the FTA announced $3 billion in aid for transit agencies to improve and strengthen their system resiliency. The funding was established in response to Hurricane Sandy, which devastated the Eastern Seaboard a year prior and left such significant damage in its wake that it became the second costliest hurricane in United States history. With Hurricane Sandy, or Superstorm Sandy, as many called it, Metro avoided significant damage when the center of the storm hit north of us, making landfall along the New Jersey shoreline. So while you can say we lucked out with that storm, we know that major weather events affecting the region have increased by as much as 20% compared to the last century, and every indication tells us that this trend will continue with stronger and more frequent storms. The risks to our system fall under three different scenarios, so I'll walk through those with you. The first scenario involves flooding as a result of a hurricane, where a storm surge pushes water up the Potomac or Anacostia River and causes flooding, where the sheer amount of water that falls during the storm itself could cause localized flooding. The photos here from 1942 show the impact that hurricane flooding can have on the district. And this scenario is closest to the risk that we averted with Superstorm Sandy. The second scenario involves a large amount of snow accumulation followed by a warm-up that causes the rapid melting of snow in the Potomac River Basin. This would push water down the river, cause flooding, and we experienced this in 1996, as you can see in these pictures. Finally, the third scenario where we're vulnerable to flooding is during an intense localized storm, when you have a storm cell that sits over a particular area and drops a large amount of rain over a short period of time. As many of you remember, a storm like this caused significant flooding in June of 2006, and this also caused flooding at Bethesda Station just this year. Today, when we know a storm is coming, we put out sandbags and take other temporary measures. We prefer permanent hardening for a number of reasons, including the fact that sandbags get stolen. Yes, people actually steal sandbags from us. When there's a major storm coming, you can imagine that we're not the only ones that are trying to protect our property from flooding. We get ahead of the storm as best as possible, so our sandbags are out there first, and then suddenly they're gone. We've often have to go out three or four times to reinforce our system because the sandbags just keep disappearing and there's little that we can do about it. To help address these issues and put permanent measures in place, Metro submitted six projects to the available FTA funding, and the Board of Directors authorized our grant applications in March of 2014. We did receive word in September that Metro would receive $20 million in federal funding, and this award is comprised of two grants and covers three of the projects that we submitted for funding. The first grant for $13.5 million will allow us to raise vent shaft openings in the Federal Triangle area, where we have three Metro Rail stations, a Federal Triangle, Smithsonian, and Archives. This is where the low-lying area is very susceptible to ponding, and stormwater often finds its way into Metro station entrances, vent shafts, and the fan shafts, essentially converting Metro into a drainage system. This project would raise the vent shafts by between 12 to 40 inches and would prevent that water from inflowing. We're working with many local agencies on this endeavor, and this includes the National Capital Planning Commission, the Commission of Fine Arts, the National Park Service, and the D.C. State Historic Preservation Office. And with the funding in hand, we will need close coordination and cooperation to move this effort forward. The $13.5 million grant will also fund the design and construction of flood prevention measures at 18 other locations across the region. For example, at stations like Cleveland Park, where we have to place sandbags around the vents whenever there's a storm, this will allow us to provide permanent hardening at these locations. The second grant for $7.5 million will allow Metro to install backflow preventers or check valves and make related improvements at 133 locations throughout the rail system. In the event of a major storm, rising storm waters can actually cause a reverse of the flow of the water, causing water to flow into the system through the drainage pipes rather than flowing out through the drainage pipes. So backflow preventers are needed to prevent this from happening. And while we have many in place today, this will provide additional check valves in strategic locations. It's worth noting that these projects will not impact service in any way and will not cause any delays or track work when they are carried out. I'm pleased that the FTA recognizes the importance of these hardening measures to maintaining our system and ensuring a safe and reliable service for our passengers. One of the reasons we were successful is because we've been working on this issue for several years, and we were well ahead of the planning process on these projects. We've identified the locations that are most vulnerable, and we're prepared to move ahead with the design and construction. The $21 million in federal funding requires a $7 million local funding match, which we have identified through the current capital budget, and which will be provided by the local jurisdictions. However, it should be noted that under the current capital funding agreement, we don't have funds identified to be used for projects like this, and as you know, we are currently negotiating our next CFA. And as Mr. Sorrells has discussed with you recently, it's important that we put a mechanism in place to provide local match funding for these type of grant applications when they become available. Thank you, and I'll take any questions you may have.
Yeah, let's take questions on this first, and then we'll go into the report on the third rail power outage. Just one clarifying question, and then we'll open up to questions from other members. The slide up there now shows what the backflow preventer will look like. Could we go back a couple slides just to see if you can, one more, if you can explain this one, what the remediation would be in place of the sandbags for the grates?
I'd probably ask Jim to explain that. Jim Ash has been working diligently on these projects. So essentially they're knee walls, but he can provide more information on that, Jim.
The basic strategy, good morning. The basic strategy is to raise the levels of the top of the vent shaft, so essentially a knee wall, if you will, to elevate it above the floodplain level or provide additional protection.
And what would be the height of that knee wall?
It varies depending on the location of the floodplain, anywhere from 12 to 40 inches.
Thank you.
Questions, Mr. Giancola?
Yes, thank you for your report. This is an important project. Clearly, we've seen flooding downtown and other parts of the area. I'm curious, what's the time frame? I know you're talking about it's been funded, but what's the time frame of completing this project?
We're still working on the schedule, sir. The grant said anywhere from 18 to 30 months. We're trying to work through the procurement process to identify when we can get these out, and they will be staged. We'll issue them in multiple contracts.
So within 3 years or 2 years?
3 years.
I just wanted to ensure, as we look at this in terms of design and change of conditions now, when we go through new designs, all of these types of measures are implemented, or some of that measures taken to ensure as we see the change?
Absolutely. The challenge here is that about 2.5 years ago, the Federal Emergency Management Administration redrew some of the floodplain maps so that areas that had previously not been within the 100-year floodplain are now within the 100-year floodplain. So in a sense, this is retrofitting.
Chair Downey?
Yeah. Two questions regarding the walls. You say they will be sufficient to, or they're based on the 100-year floodplain. Is that the level of flood that they would prevent?
They're based on the 100-year floodplain. One of the challenges is, in some places, depending on the final elevation of the floodplain, understand FEMA has not promulgated the version of the map that will appear after the wall on the 17th Street levee is completed. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges is, in some places, they can be 10 feet high. So what we're looking at doing is putting in some additional measures that would allow us to seal off the inside that would give us a basic level of flood protection, but in a more severe case, we just close the vent shaft completely.
And then what interagency coordination will be needed to put these structures in place?
We have already reached out to the Commission of Fine Arts, National Capital Planning Commission, the State Historic Preservation Office in the District of Columbia.
Park Service.
Park Service, absolutely, because they controlled much of the land that we're working with. And we are talking with them about this.
And talking in the context of this is really preventing some serious emergencies.
That's correct. Yes, sir.
I want to recognize Ms. Trigoning, a new member joining us today from the federal government. Harriet, welcome, and take the floor.
Thank you very much. So this is a great set of illustrations that I think highlight potential issues. So on the right-hand side, you can see that the vents are not actually in the kind of pedestrian right-of-way. And on the lower side, which looks like Cleveland Park, you can see that that is part of the pedestrian right-of-way and how narrow the walk is on the other side. So I think it's important to coordinate with the local jurisdictions and maybe look at designing not just for flood prevention. In some cases, a knee wall could be a pedestrian respite, an amenity. It could act as a bench. In other cases, it might call for a redesign of the width or the location of the vent so that you still have the ability for pedestrians to walk. Obviously, with the sandbags, people aren't walking there, but I think otherwise, you know, throughout the city, those vent shafts actually are part of the pedestrian right-of-way. So I would just urge us to do that. I mean, one example is the Jersey barriers throughout the city that came into existence after 9/11, some of which are still there. The evolution of the integration of security into landscape and other amenities, I think, came to full flower with the redesign at the Lincoln Memorial, where you can no longer even see the security barriers. They're so integral to the landscape and to the amenity experience that's there for the visitors. It would be great if we could do something that's similarly integrated as we do this flood protection project.
Thank you.
Other questions? Mr. Costa?
Morning. I think the only thing I'd add is we might also want to talk to property owners. I know the General Services Administration is designing similar mitigation factors, and I think, frankly, if we think about that all combining, it might actually make flooding worse because everyone's trying to do the same thing, and we'll get more channeling. So we should probably talk to those folks too, property owners.
We've met several times with the General Services Administration as we've worked through this. So it's absolutely.
Thanks.
Question for either Mr. Trooper or Mr. Ash. You mentioned that you're going to have to reprogram these funds under the CIP. Have you begun discussions with the jurisdictions yet as to what their recommendations would be as to which programs should be cut to replace for this one?
The Office of OMBS has been working on that, I know. So they've identified that through the next.
And is there a timetable for beginning that conversation?
I honestly don't know. I can find out. Yeah.
Someone's going to give us the answer.
Good morning, everyone. We're beginning those conversations now. I think we anticipate coming back to the F&A committee in either January or February with an actual motion to amend the FY15 budget to include these grants, and so when we have the reprogramming or the moving of the funds, we'll have that in place then.
And what's the total amount that will have to be reprogrammed?
So the federal grant is $21 million, and so the match is $7 million, so we'll just have to move that amount of funding.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. Mr. Ash, but we won't let Mr. Troop leave yet.
Thank you.
All right, so do you want to give us a little briefing on this week's third rail power outage?
Certainly. On the morning of November 18th at approximately 6:52, the rail OCC received indication that we had third rail power de-energized on track 2 between Potomac Avenue and Eastern Market. We did have two trains in that section of track that ended up on dead third rail. So we began to offload certain trains to be able to provide train spacing for those. We did not provide the passengers did stay on the trains in the tunnels. So we began to manage the traffic around that. Obviously, maintenance personnel were called in, and at approximately 7:25, we were able to restore third rail power to those trains. The one train made Eastern Market at 7:29, and the other train made Potomac Avenue at 7:35. So we were able to get those trains back into the station after about an hour and a half into the incident. The reason for the incident, we have what's called a tie breaker station, which ties two traction power substations together, and then adjacent to that is a traction power substation. The tiebreaker station, we had a relay fail at the tiebreaker station. When that relay failed, we had a subsequent failure on a rate of rise relay at the adjacent traction power substation. That rate of rise relay failed and opened up. The rate of rise relay essentially looks at the difference between a train drawing power and what would be an instantaneous short on the line. So it actually looks at the rate of rise in the current. That rate of rise relay failed. It was looking at it as a short. So what happened was it opened it up, and then you get three closures. You get a chance for three closures on that, and like I said, with that relay in failure, the third rail power went dead. The minute we got crews there, within 5 minutes they were able to restore power on those. These two locations, the one location was just recently installed, and the DO6 location, which is the tiebreaker station, was installed under Metro Matters in 2007. We're in the middle of analyzing those relays to make a determination exactly why they failed and whether there's anything systemic in the system for those. We don't believe that there is, we just think it was those two incidents happening simultaneously.
Is there any suspicion that this was weather-related to the cold?
No. No, we do not consider that.
So it's a failure of a part.
Yeah, right. Okay. We do not consider that to be the case because these are enclosed in this traction power substations room and in the tiebreaker rooms, which are climate-controlled.
And does the failure of the part cause a failure to systems other than the third rail power? Are the signals also down? Or based?
Third rail power is totally independent. We keep it totally independent from all the other power station power and everything else specifically for those reasons. So that did not, there was no subsequent failure to anything else.
Questions? Mr. Chair Downing.
Yes, the trains that were delayed were about an hour between the time of the.
Yeah, it's a little bit more than an hour.
But not, this was not the height of the rush hour.
Actually, it was right before the height of the rush.
And there was no self-evacuation.
There was no self-evacuation. Right. No.
So the customers stayed.
Yeah, which is very good because had there been a self-evacuation on two trains, we would have been into this incident well through the rush hour, well through 9 o'clock to be able to, you know, because then we have to take, anytime there's self-evacuation, we have to take
power down
on both tracks because we don't know where those passengers are going, and then we would have had to establish the bus bridge.
Thank you. Any other questions? I just have one more. Sir? What happens to the trains coming that are still on power track? Do they hit a red signal, or do they just stop dead when they hit the section of track?
If they're on the same track, they would be essentially, because they have a train ahead of them, they do know that. So it's the track circuit itself is independent from the traction power. And that the track circuit feeds basically the train control information to the trains that are approaching. So they may hit a red signal, but they also have cab signal indications. So they have cab signal indications that define their speed, so they would slow down appropriately for that. Plus, the other thing is the RCC knows that we now have third rail power down, so they would start managing adjacent or traffic coming into that area appropriately.
No safety problem.
There was no safety issue with that. No.
Thank you. Chair Downing.
Separate question. Any indication, I know it's early, but as to the cracked rail yesterday on the Orange Line?
We do not have any indication of the cracked rail. It was by a weld. We do know that.
Yeah.
We're looking at that. But also what we have noticed is there was a small internal defect next to it, so we're not entirely sure whether the defect or it was a weld defect or whether it was an internal defect. You know, that just happened to be where the weld is. So we have cut that piece of rail out, and we're sending that out for metallurgical tests on that. So that's being done today.
Thank you. I was caught on that one. I can tell you the announcements were good, and the length of time it took to resolve was good.
Yeah, and it's you know, as with all these things, it's in the worst location. So, yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Troop.
Thank you.
We'll now have Bereshef.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you. Good morning. Mr. Chair, the committee, good morning, committee. Doug is today to update board safety committee on the TAC activities since last our presentation, I think 4 months ago. So today we are going to talk about TAC follow-up on Silver Line Phase 1 and our activities, oversight activities on Silver Line Phase 2. Also, we will present information on our activities overseeing the 7000 series rail car safety certification. At the same time, we are conducting our 3-year safety and security reviews, and we will update board on those activities. We cover accident incident investigations and corrective action plans. So the first one is the TAC oversight of Silver Line Phase 1. As you know, TAC work with WMATA through pre-revenue operations and to address findings from TAC pre-revenue service review and to address findings we thought need to be corrected before opening, and some findings are still open, and we are working with WMATA to correct those findings. And TAC is tracking all findings and will track them to the completion. Some items have a long time required to be completed. At the same time, there was, as you know, there was involvement of the Virginia DGS, Department of General Services, and some findings that TAC consider not safe or needed to be completed. We had different opinions with DGS. So at this point, we are trying to reach and schedule a meeting with DGS to discuss these findings and find common ground and come to completion what needs to be done and resolve these problems. There were many lessons that we learned from phase one, and we are trying to incorporate them, that we will incorporate them in the phase two safety oversight, safety and security oversight activities of the TAC. We are waiting, our understanding that WMATA is working on compiling the lessons learned from their experience. We received lessons learned from Office of Safety, and we have our own lessons we learned. So we will combine them and take in consideration for the phase two oversight activities. Phase two is now in full construction mode and design and construction. TAC is participating in the main safety security related committee meetings. It's a safety certification working group meetings. We review documentation and the checklist as they come available and make our comments. And we are working based on the lessons learned from phase two, we are working on updating our safety and security oversight management plan for the Dallas Corridor Metro Rail, which we call STOMP, and there will be STOMP for phase two. TAC oversight of 7000 series rail car. 7000 series rail car is a part of phase one project. And TAC also oversees this project on a continuous basis. We are reviewing and have been reviewing safety and security certification documentation. We notified WMATA that we will be doing the pre-revenue review, similar to what we did on Silver Line. And to start that review. We are waiting for announcement of the conditional acceptance of the rail car. And after that, as we outlined in our notification to WMATA, we will have 30 days to review all pertinent documentation. We will have to have 2 days at least of field review and 30 days after that to prepare our draft report and with our findings, if any.
Want to ask a question at this point? Mr. Dyke? Ms. Barishev?
The second bullet where you said POC members have concerns about WMATA's safety certification, could you elaborate a little bit on that?
As I said, we are reviewing just a little bit background on safety certification process. Safety certification is an independent process that required by FTA for the projects this magnitude, over $100 million. Again, it's a separate from engineering process, and that should be conducted by safety and security personnel. This process is process of verification that all hazards, that known hazards were eliminated, designed out, or mitigated to lowest possible level, and during design and construction testing, no new hazards were introduced. So, for that, Office of Safety, WMATA, is overseeing safety certification for 7,000 cars. We reviewed documentation, and we have concern how the hazard, the items related to hazard are verified. We notified WMATA. We talked about this many times, and about 2 weeks ago, we sent a letter to WMATA stating that we have our concern, and we will be working on correcting. We think it has to be corrected.
I think this is an area that's going to produce a number of questions from different members, so could I suggest that we let Ms. Barishev finish the report, and then we'll open it up to have a broad conversation on tax concerns and how they can be addressed. Ms. Barishev.
Thank you. So as I said, we will conduct a safety readiness review after WMATA is conditional acceptance of their colors. We are not we are not concerned about timing of this conditional acceptance. We're just waiting whenever it happened. Timing is not our concern. And we are waiting for that date, but as I said, it's not really important for us. Anytime it's announced, we are ready to start our revenue review. 3 year safety and security review. During the most of the 2014, before the opening of Silver Line, TAC suspended triennial reviews not to distract WMATA personnel from getting ready for opening of the Silver Line. So right now we have kind of more condensed schedule, and we are trying to catch up with what we canceled during the preparation for Silver Line opening. TAC has received full cooperation from WMATA in arranging audits. Anytime we schedule an audit, we have full cooperation, support, documentation provided, facility scheduled, personnel in place. So I think WMATA does a very good job supporting TAC in this matter. And as usual, we recommend WMATA to conduct audits, their internal audits, together with us to save on time and assets, because same people are involved in the internal and our triennial reviews. Audits result in CAP to ensure compliance with procedures and enhance existing safety and security practices. When we find something deficient, we recommend to PUMATA issue a CAP, and the CAP is carried through the CAP database to completion. So these are some three-year safety and security reviews that we conducted, and we will conduct in December of this year. So in September, we conducted shop safety and equipment inspections, and the draft report already sent to WMATA for review and comments. In October, we conducted emergency management review, and this is our report is due to WMATA on Monday, and it's almost ready, going through the last cycle of reviews internally. In November, we just completed, actually this week, field review of station maintenance, and in 30 days, we have another meeting with ARTRA, and after that, in 30 days, we will provide a draft report on this audit. In December, we will conduct two audits. One is tunnel emergency exit and equipment, and elevator escalator maintenance. Accident incident investigations. As of November 7, 59 open accident incident investigations. TAC adoption of WMATA investigations in the third quarter of 2014 such. From July 8 to November 7, there was 24 incidents or accidents closed and 29 were added. From April 10 to July 7, 22 were closed and 20 were added. TAC continues to monitor WMATA's investigation of the October 6, 2013 contractor fatality near Union Station. This incident is still not completed and open. WMATA has retained a third-party consultant to investigate an uptick in the red signal violation. For this, WMATA and TAC also noted the increased number of red signal violations, and WMATA hired or retained a contractor who will study these situations and make recommendations how to decrease red light violations. Even it seems like a simple matter, red light is red light, it continues to happen. And I should say there were many mitigations that WMATA done to try to decrease science training and others, and still is not completely working to prevent it from happening. So I think it's very good that we can get recommendations from outside. Corrective action plan update. As of October 14, 126 open safety-related CAPs and two security-related CAPs we have in our database. WMATA has added CAPs resulting from the February 2014 TAC roadway worker protection audit, several finalized accident incident investigations, and WMATA internal audits. As I said, when we do triennial audits, we also findings report to WMATA and required to create CAPs. CAP effort is well resourced internally and making good progress overall. TAC conduct monthly CAP meetings with WMATA, and more and more we required subject matter experts to attend these meetings to provide technical support for the for mitigations. That were the same for the accident incident investigations. We have monthly meeting where we discuss accidents and incidents, and monthly meetings for CAPS. At each meeting, I think the process improved. At each meeting, we see more and more subject matter experts attending, and it helps us to resolve many problems much more quicker than, and I think it was much more quality than before. Look ahead. So we will monitor completion of long-term mitigations resulting from Silver Line Phase 1 findings, continue oversight of Silver Line Phase 2. We are working on implementation of MAP 21 work plan that was approved by FDA, conduct ongoing three-year safety and security reviews, and we'll conduct readiness review of 7th series rail car when we receive information that it was conditional accept.
Thank you, Ms. Barashev. I think your report is both timely and raises a number of questions and issues. As you saw, some of those questions preceded the normal Q&A process and period, but I think we'll turn to that now. So questions from members of the committee? Chairman Downs, Mr. Dyke, Ms. Hutchins?
I need to have more information about the apparent disagreement about the standards for the rail car safety review. As I understand it, the recommendation is 100% element review on every car versus a statistical sampling of each of the elements. Is that an accurate statement about the difference?
Yes, 100% review or random review.
Is that, Rob, is that your understanding of the gym?
I mean, if we could, you know, there's various elements, propulsion, braking, you know, for the rail cars. And we are doing a 100% verification. In other words, we get the test reports from Kawasaki, and those are all being looked at by the safety staff as part of the certification. So we are doing that for the elements for every car. Every car will have an established history book. And in the history book for every vehicle, we go through and check and inspect and make sure that nothing has been omitted that the manufacturer is required to do under their contract.
Explain to me then the difference between the TOC and you about the processes for the review of the safety of the passenger's car.
We are following the FDA's guidebook for safety and security certification. In the languages, each of the elements, you know, the major components, we are going through and we are checking them. As far as where the talk's going, I will have to certainly defer to Mrs. Barashev on where that is, because we are following the guidelines established by the FDA and in most cases even exceed what is required. So I'm not sure what is it. I guess I have to ask, what is it we're not checking, since at this point in time we don't have all the test records? I can't certify what I don't have as the cars are being built. As soon as we have those records, we are verifying what that means, that the engineer or the appropriate party has signed off and provided the reports. We're not physically doing those tests. We are making sure that they did the test, the responsible party.
Not only by the board, but by the public, because this has implications for the acceptance of these cars in terms of the time frame. I don't think it's in the best interest of the authority to have that either be a vague or misunderstood set of safety review standards, and as a result, not being able to accurately forecast an acceptance final acceptance schedule for these cars. I think this board needs that explanation in writing from both parties as soon as you can sit down and clarify the language that you're going to use about what you respectively think is the process to meet the FDA review standard. I'd suggest that we get that sooner rather than later and not wait a month to have that back to the board.
Can I state that we do have a safety and security certification plan, and that lays out and details the process that we work with Kawasaki.
It is not enough if the TOC is disputing part of that plan. We need to understand what the TOC is saying and where it's going and how we resolve it as quickly as possible.
If I may.
Ms. Barashev.
As WMATA has a system-wide, company-wide system safety and security certification plan. However, this project, which is over $100 million, required per FDA requirement, required project-specific safety and security certification plan, which we still need to see.
Would it be possible, Ms. Barashev, that we can get what you just said in writing as to what you need from WMATA so we can try and bring this to a head? Something we could get? I don't want to ask for it by Thanksgiving, but is that something we can get by the end
of
the
month? And we discussed specifics with the safety office many times. It was not in writing, maybe, except the letter we sent 2 weeks ago. But okay, no problem.
Differences. Sure. I don't think the board has any way of clarifying what those differences are and a time frame for resolving them and a framework for resolving them. We need that. This board needs that. We're going to be accountable to the funders and to the public and to the jurisdictions about the final delivery of these cars.
I understand that we are for. We will do it.
And there is a specific certification plan for the cars, correct? Yes, sir. Lou Brown's our assistant chief safety officer. He is, besides being a PE, here is working the project here for WMATA on the safety staff and actually is the one that's in lead of the safety certification of the cars. So, but we will get you on our end, sir, what you're asking for.
So we'll look forward to getting both something in writing from staff as well as from the TOC trying to explain what they perceive to be the differences in the two agencies' positions. And hopefully, may I ask that we try and get that by the end of the month? Thank you. Okay. Further questions?
Also that we be prepared to discuss this with the FTA in terms of what their requirements are.
Thank you. Further questions? Sergeant?
Are we through with that portion?
No, further questions on the 7,000 rail car issues? Mr. Boulder.
Chairman, thank you. I just want to know if this is going to delay acceptance and then therefore operation of the 7,000 series cars in any way.
There certainly is a potential for that.
Excuse me?
There certainly is a potential for that.
Really, Rich?
Yes.
Okay, well then to add on to what Tom, Chairman, was saying, maybe we should also have some understanding of what the potential time frame looks like or expectation looks like in terms of accepting these new rail cars.
Well, as I understand from Ms. Barashev, they will need, once the conditional date of acceptance is established, they will need 2 days to do field tests and then up to 30 days after that to do their review and issue a report. So you've got 32 days there. Delay. Am I correct? She's shaking her head. Yes, sir.
Well, 32 to me. 32 days times how many? You know, that's how I kind of look at these things. It could be months and months and months. And I think the board really, we need these rail cars as fast as we can get them online to get the 1,000 series cars offline. So.
Especially since it's a safety improvement.
Yeah.
Further questions on the 7,000 rail car issues?
Yeah, just to reinforce what Mr. Charles said, every day we don't accept the 7,000 series, we're continuing to run the 1,000 series. I had another question. With respect to the Virginia DGS work, which I gather is the issuance of certificates of occupancy for the stations, I'd like to know from staff how we resolve an issue where we must get the state of Virginia to certify to operate the station, and a difference of opinion with the TOC as to what those requirements are, and frankly, a legal opinion as to which set of views we have to take advice from.
Yeah, the Department of General Services is a regulatory agency which requires certificate of occupancies for those. So we complied with all the regulatory requirements.
And they issued the certificate.
And they issued the certificates of occupancy
which
on that.
The board relied on in order to say go forward. And
correct. The TOC issues were recommendations that they felt you needed further clarification, mostly around signage. Was the issue, but it was in conflict with what DGS, which was what the regulatory requirements were. So they're working independently with DGS to provide resolution on that.
But so in the meantime, we are perfectly well in compliance.
In the meantime, we are in compliance with all of DGS's requirements. They would not have issued the certificate of occupancy without that.
And so should the DGS decide different standards are called for, can they do that after the building is open?
That I don't, I'd have to get a legal opinion on that. I do not know that.
But frankly, if they came up with different standards, we would try to comply.
Sure. Ms. Hudgens, did you still have a question?
Still do, yes. I'm going to catch up. Mr. Downey, you went to the point that I wanted to go through, and understanding that there are going to be conflicts, or there was when we started this on the review, that there were conflicts with DGS. Can you go back and share with us where we are on that list? Because as we accepted the system, and we had a list that we were to go back and complete. Right now, it would be good to understand where we are in that process, how much more is there, and how many conflicts we are having.
Specifically for the Department of General Services, we are not in any conflicts with those. We, you know, the certificate of occupancies, all the signage and everything, we have been completed on those. So, again, they issued there is no conditional certificate of occupancies on those. So, in regards to that, there are a number of open punch list items that are required, which are separate from those regulatory issues that are out there. There are a number of punch list items that we're dealing with. For the Silver Line, so I'm not entirely sure. Did you want to speak about those or about the regulatory requirements from DGS for the stations? And
well, I would like to talk about the list, because I think what is the concern is that where are we on the progress of it? Do we think that we're moving through that in the same framework as we were before? And what might be the expectations of when we will complete that?
Oh, certainly, yeah, we are working through the list of the open items. We have gotten since good cooperation from them on that. They've actually put on more staff on that because enable us to move forward on that much quicker. There are some items that are going to be a little bit longer lead, moving some of the emergency trip stations require a little bit more time to be able to do that, but I do believe we're working through the open item list quickly.
They've also gone to the extent of hiring a separate contractor to advance this so that they move along. It's good cooperation. Sometimes we get a little anxious about a couple of things, you know, a little impatient, but they move it along.
Thank you.
Further questions? Ms. Fryership, I did have one further question on the slide on incident investigations, where you had a conversation about the red signal, the uptick in red signal violations. I'm just trying to understand, what is the timeline here? The TOC is waiting for a report from WMATA's third-party contractor.
Right. We are relying on WMATA's contract with this company. I forgot the name. WMATA provided that scope of work, and we will wait for results and recommendations.
And then will the TOC be making recommendations? I mean, I agree with you that this idea of operators going through red lights is a very serious problem. I'm trying to understand how we get to the point where there is a contractor and then a TOC recommendation that
we need to
board,
see the results
on
of that, you know, that project, the recommendations from the consultant company.
And Mr. Tripp, can you give us an update on what the timeline is for getting that report from the contractor?
Yeah, the consultant will be on the property December 1 through the 3rd to be able to do interviews, make assessments of the information. They'll also be providing some training classes during the period of time that they're here, so that, you know, to our supervisory staff in the Rail OCC and also to some of the supervisory staff of the train operators, to be able to identify potentials that we have that we can deal with right away, and then within 30 days, they're going to present basically a computer-based training class that deals with some of the physiological reasons that these things occur for our train operators. And you know, we'll look at that and make determinations of whether we want to implement that. You know, and then from that point, then within a 45-day period, that we will have their recommendations in regard to the red signal violations. But I do want to point out that we have done, you know, we have not been static during that period of time that we've had this uptick. We have initiated some of our own issues. One of the things is simply an awareness, and what we've done is we've implemented it's a random call out for the signals. And what we do is at the beginning of a run, an operator will get a list and will say, okay, at DO6, you need to call out what that signal is. So it gets them aware of what's going on to be able to, you know, pay attention to these things. We've also instructed RCC staff that in the event of an incident, which is when a lot of this will happen, when we are either signal tracking because of an emergency situation or when an operator is turning a train back and they have to go from one end to the other, they get sort of out of their normal habit and routine. What we've done is instructed RCC staff to make sure that they provide distinct information to the train operators, to have callbacks for those signals so that they can call those signals out, and also to remind the operators that, you know, you're now in a different situation. And consistency of communications is one of the things, too, so the operators are hearing the same things at the same time, the same way, consistently through the RCC. So we're starting to push those items through. So, again, we haven't remained static on all this, in addition to the other things that we've put out there. But we're very excited to get this consultant on.
So I understand the steps you're taking, but could you provide for the committee just a chronology of when you expect, what you've said, when the consultant will show up, when he will have his recommendations, right, and when he will provide a final report that will be shared with the TOC, so we can sort of figure when the TOC will be in a position to give us their recommendations.
We can provide that in a memo, if that's okay.
Thank you very much. Chair Downey?
With respect to that on the red signal study, will the consultant be looking at human factors issues?
That's specific.
I mean, particularly fatigue, sleep apnea, and other conditions that might cause an operator to not be aware of the signal?
They will be, and that's specifically why I engaged them, because it is a human factor issue. We've done, looking at signal intensity, placement of signals, sight lines, all the physical things that could be around. You know, we've gone through the system and demonstrated that, so it's a human factors issue. It's interesting when we engage them. You know, the way that the brain processes information is very important for people to be cognizant of that when they are in a different situation and when they're operating the train. So, yes, all those issues.
So we'll call your attention to the National Transportation Safety Board report yesterday with respect to sleep apnea.
Spolger?
Mr. Downey asked a question. I was going to ask the same.
Any other questions, members of the committee? Thank you, Ms. Marishev. We look forward to having you again in February of next year, and hopefully we'll be able to have the 7,000 rail cars running when you come back, and you'll give us a sign of approval on that.
Thank you.
That completes the scheduled agenda for the Safety and Security Committee today. Right now, the committee is not scheduled to meet next month, but depending on where we go on the 7,000 rail cars, it may be necessary to schedule a meeting in December of the committee to review the documents received from staff and the TOC. Our next scheduled meeting is January 22nd. When we will have a very detailed meeting. We will have both a safety report from Mr. Dougherty. We will have a report on security, quarterly report from Chief Pavlik. And we will have a report on cybersecurity measures that are being taken by the staff, a very timely issue these days. State Department was down for two or three days this week because of a effort by somebody to hack into their systems. I think that completes matters before the committee. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.